Thank you very much, Peter. Good morning. I think you are up there. I'm very pleased to have been invited to come here. And I'm also grateful to Arthur to actually give you all the difficult facts, all the bad news. And perhaps this is the point to start looking at the silver lining in this challenge of climate change. And I want to start by telling you that even though I'm in the middle of mankind's efforts to deal with this challenge, I remain fundamentally optimistic. And of course, it's difficult to separate the degree to which that optimism comes from the guidance that I seek from Baha'u'llah. But you could also turn this around and say that climate change is the best thing that could have happened to mankind. It's a good problem in many ways, because the solution to this problem lies in unity, it lies in taking the ethical high road, and to actually once for all accept that we are only one humanity on this planet. And I'm not saying this just kind of because it's a Saturday morning and we are in a group of friends. I'm saying this as a fundamental reality. And I think when historians will look back at the way climate change was addressed collectively by mankind, they will see in it the emergence of a fully integrated world community. As Peter told you, I do work for all of you. I work for the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. And this is a treaty body, a secretariat established by the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change that was negotiated just before Rio. And that's where we met Peter for the first time. I can confirm that. And that's where the Framework Convention was finally signed. It has subsequently resulted in a protocol connected to the city of Kyoto, the Kyoto Protocol, many of you will have heard of. And the reason why negotiations are now underway is the fact that the first commitment period of the Kyoto Protocol, 2008 to 2012, is coming to the end of that is in sight. And so that's why the world community is now coming together to try to decide what next. And that's what I will try to do with you. Our secretariat, in addition to supporting the negotiations, is also involved with the actual implementation of this effort. And there are a lot of things that are actually good things that are happening, but I won't go into that. I will focus here on the negotiations. And I think it is important to start, and I can't even see, I hope you do see the view graph I've just put up. I'm sure it's coming. Is it there? Okay. And here you see four boxes. And I'm going to be talking to you mainly on the middle box on the right side, the whole question of international treaty provisions. And it's didn't want to be constrained by this box, so it's actually grown out of the box. But there are other very important processes that you need to think of, and it's all part of this collective effort. You heard now Arthur talk about the science and the economics and the actions of civil society, and that's the foundation on which all of this happens. But it happens at mainly at two levels, at the national level, where there are national policy developments that are quite important. And then what is also very important, and I want to tell you about, is the fact that climate change has now reached the highest level of governments in the world. You rarely have leaders of the world coming together now without talking about climate change, and that's a recent development. And in my view, and I will referred to that a couple of times, the solution will actually come from informed leaders rising up to the challenge of climate change and charting a way forward. There are several examples of recent changes in national policy. Last year, a very significant change happened in Australia, when Australia, with a change of government, and the first act of that new government was to ratify the Kyoto Protocol. And there is also, as many of you know, impending change, quite significant change, in the national policy on climate change in this country, the United States. And all of these boxes are interconnected, but I'm focusing mainly on the international treaty provisions and the negotiations. And this is a rough timeline, and here I'm showing you, as a function of time, just the last, from 2006, 7, 8, and 9, three levels: the science, the negotiations at the level of the United Nations, and then at the highest level of governments in the context of the G8, the group of the largest economies, and the General Assembly. And the, if you look at the science box, 2006, and in particular 2007, was very significant in the fact that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the most successful scientific advisory process in existence in this on this planet, resulted in its fourth assessment. And it's a five-year process that led to that assessment. And with that assessment, you can in a sense say that science was not an issue anymore. That issue was closed with the AR4. But the Stern review that Alfred also referred to really underlined the fact that it was more expensive to ignore the problem than to solve the problem. In other words, living with the impacts of climate change is more expensive than addressing them. What I'm talking to you about is mainly this middle band. Copenhagen is a deadline that was established in Bali last year to conclude negotiations on the next step in acting on climate change. And in the middle there, you have, at the end of 2007, the agreement to what was called the Bali Roadmap. And this is a two-year roadmap for the international community to come together. But it's important to note that when it comes to climate change, the eight most powerful countries on the Earth have decided to bring to their meetings five additional economies: China, India, Korea, South Africa, and Mexico, to consult on climate change, because they have seen that as essential to the solution. But these, and when I'm talking about the General Assembly here, I'm not talking about the annual session of the General Assembly. I'm talking about the two points when the Secretary General, which is very committed to climate change, will be inviting heads of government to come to New York to talk about climate change. And that was done in 2007 and has just been announced that that will happen again in the lead up to Copenhagen. What I want to do now is to give you a very simplified picture of the ethical dimensions of this issue. And this is a very simplified picture, but I'm looking at it both in the past and in the future. If you first look at the past, which is the first column, both in terms of emissions, the causes of the problem, and then in terms of impacts, suffering the results of the problem, things are fairly simple when it comes to the past. It's quite clear that historic responsibility rests with the industrialized countries, and that is something that Arthur outlined very clearly to you. And also then, on the impact side, we come to this, really the saddest fact about climate change, and that is the fact that those that have least contributed to the problem suffer the greatest consequences. And that leads to adaptation, action to adapt to climate change to reduce vulnerability. What is more complicated is then, what does this mean for the future? And this is best to illustrate, perhaps, by thinking about what this means for India and China, for example. These are economies that are now growing and developing fast. And so the question is, will historical responsibility still be the main guiding ethical principle here? And so the question is this about sharing out the what has been called the carbon space, because the atmosphere has limited capacity to receive greenhouse gases? So in a simplified way, you could say the issue is now we have in the rich world had our chance. Now it's the time for India and China to have their access to the atmosphere. And that was kind of the initial approach to this issue. This is changing, and I think it's important for you to understand that this is changing for fundamental reasons. And one of those reasons is that there are basically two things behind that strategic move by China in particular, is that they do see it in their best interest to act on climate change because of the opportunities in the low carbon economy. They do not want to go down the route that that we did in the industrialized world, and they do want to seize the opportunities in the low carbon future. And then it also, when it comes to impacts, this is very important as well, because the countries that are now vulnerable, they are on a development path. And it's very important that that development path is resilient to climate and climate impacts. And that so the objective there is climate resilient development. And I don't want to spend too much time on this figure, but this is looking ahead now into the remainder of the century. And you see there are three black lines, starting in 1990 and ending in 2050. And the center line is the global emissions for all of humanity. And there is a growing understanding that those would need to, at the minimum, be reduced by 50% by 2050. And so this is the objective of the negotiations now, to, in a sense, prevent the worst predictions of science from ever becoming realized. But what is important for you to understand then is the two lines that are around this center line. The lower line is the industrialized countries, and it's quite clear that they cannot continue growing their emissions, and they will need to take urgent action to reduce them. Developing countries will continue to grow, and the question now is, when will they peak and also start to decline? So this is kind of the objective of the whole effort. So what are the topics? How do these negotiations actually happen? And there are really three central foci that this is all centered about. And the first one is the whole question of the sense of direction, the shared vision for long-term cooperative action. And here are words, these are words that were negotiated. These are not my words. These are the words from the Bali roadmap. And this is the question of not just the graph that I showed you in terms of the targets and timetables, but also how governments will be cooperating. And the second one, of course, it's clear that there needs to be enhanced action, both in terms of adapting to the impacts of climate change and enhanced action of what is called mitigation. Mitigation basically means reducing emissions, going to the root of the problem. But that's not enough. And that's why the third area there, which is central to the deal at the moment, is delivering finance and technology. And I want to say a few words about that, because it's so central to the solution. And so what I'll do now is I will show you how these things interrelate: enhanced action on adaptation and mitigation on one hand, and delivering finance and technology. If we first look at the top box, which is the objective of enhanced action on adaptation and mitigation, and on the bottom you have the question of finance and technology. And it's quite, if we first look at that, finance and technology is required. It's essential to as a means to enable action. And that's why we have this arrow connecting up to enabling the action. The question now is how to generate this finance. And it's quite clear that even with the optimistic change in government's attitude, they do not simply have the resources to pay and to finance all the action. And that's why it is essential, to some extent, that this is not entirely so, that the Global Compact is self-financing in a sense. And we do already have early indications that this can be done. And that's what I'm referring to here through the resources generated from action. And we do already have from the Kyoto experience a mechanism is called Clean Development Mechanism, which is mobilizes projects in developing countries, gives them credits that they for the reductions that they have achieved, which can then be sold on the international carbon market. And this comes down to what Arthur said earlier, quoting Nicholas Stern, Sir Nicholas Stern, where he characterized climate change as the largest market failure mankind has ever seen. What does that mean? Market failure means when you have a situation where the market doesn't see the real cost, and the cost is not internalized in the actions. And that is essential, that is the most powerful policy tool, and that is to actually cap the emissions, to limit the emissions, and then allow trade between actors to achieve the lowest cost actions. And so a very central element of all of this is to use the power of the market to actually move the technology and mobilize the finance. And it's very encouraging that the incoming president in this country is committed to using that tool in this country in a similar way that it has been effectively used in Europe. So, what are the requisites for success? And here, I mean, this list could be longer. I have told you that I'm fundamentally optimistic, I have good reasons to be so, but there are really five things that need to come together. First is this whole question of rising up to the responsibility and being accountable for actions. And that is one of the fundamental things, and I'm seeing that happening, and you can see that with the way leaders are speaking at the moment. But there's also enormous opportunities for leadership and innovation. I think it has been, you have heard about this, the Stone Age didn't end because there were no more stones. And the same will happen with the fossil fuel age. And so I come from a country, Iceland, where all the electricity is produced from renewables, and it's definitely possible. And so there are so many benefits from actually weaning the economy from reliance on fossil fuels. But this really has to be done through global solidarity and appreciation of the unity of mankind and unprecedented level of international cooperation. And I didn't maybe draw your attention to the central box that connects together this image here, and that is the institutional arrangements. Because you cannot have a market without regulation. And so that is one of the central things that the process is looking at the moment. And that's why you will be seeing enhanced global governance and institutions emerging out of this process that for the first time regulate mankind's access to the atmosphere. Because in a sense, similar to the financial crisis, the central reason for the climate crisis is that mankind has been living beyond its means. It has been taxing the atmosphere beyond its capacity to absorb this. But I want to end by bringing this all back to the whole question of unity as a prerequisite, as a key to the solution. And this quote is on the cover of Arthur's book, Unless and Until. And it has stuck with me for quite some time. And but it's as I indicated to you earlier, I believe that this climate problem will be only be solved effectively through appreciation of the unity of mankind. Thank you very much.